In the matter of State versus Courtney, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Daniel Rockoff, Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Mr. Courtney.
Good morning, Your Honor. Aiden O'Connor, Peschenstein, Walter Hayden, on behalf of Amicus, Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey.
Good morning, Your Honor. Paul Heinzel, Assistant Somerset County Prosecutor, on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jennifer E. Kamisiak, Deputy Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Attorney General, Amicus Curiae.
Morning, all counsel, and thank you for participating in this matter remotely. Justice LaVecchia will be participating. She's not on for the argument this morning, but she will review the recording of this argument. Mr. Rockoff, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Before I begin, I would just request the opportunity for a minute or two of rebuttal time.
That's fine.
Thank you. May it please the court. My client's a middle-aged man who has never previously been to prison. This is his first prison sentence. The offense involved no weapon, no violence. And my client himself, neurologically, has only borderline level intellectual function and has an IQ in the population's second percentile. So these are mitigating circumstances. It would have been a perfectly reasonable exercise of discretion for the sentencing court to impose a term at the bottom of the first degree range, 10 years with a parole disqualifier set at one-third. The prosecutor recommended a term in the middle of the first degree range and also declined to apply for a Section 6F extended term. Thus, the bottom of the first degree range was the statutory floor. The prosecutor's recommendation was the ceiling, and defense counsel specifically requested that the court consider a lower sentence. But the court wrongly held that it had no discretion. This court should reverse and hold that when a prosecutor recommends a term above the statutory floor and also declines to apply for a Section 6F extended term, Section 12 of the Act does not deprive the court of discretion. Now, it's plain that the legislature intended Section 12 to limit judicial discretion in some drug cases. Section 12 limits discretion where the term recommended by the prosecutor is less than the sentence mandated. But Section 12 doesn't limit judicial discretion when the prosecutor's recommendation, as in this case, is not less than the sentence mandated. The state's tried to argue that Section 12 limited the judge's discretion here because the recommendation was less than the Section 6F term it did not apply for. But this court's unequivocally held the legislature did not mandate Section 6F extended sentences, that's in Ligarix, recognizing that enhanced punishment may be unwarranted. Rather, Section 6F, according to this court, takes effect only on the prosecutor's application. You should not interpret Section 12 to limit the judge's discretion, even where the prosecutor's recommendation is greater than the sentence mandated. It's critical that in circumstances like these, Section 12 not limit judicial sentencing discretion, at least until and unless the prosecutor has actually chosen to apply for Section 6F in compliance with the legislature's procedural requirements. And here the prosecutor never did. For the draconian consequences of limiting judicial discretion, I would refer you to the November 2019 Sentencing Commission report. That report documented how the curtailment of judicial discretion in the drug war has contributed to an exponential increase in New Jersey's prison population and contributed to racial disparities dwarfing those of other states. At least 8 former attorneys general have denounced rules stripping courts of discretion in the sentencing of nonviolent drug offenders and said such rules don't work and don't make the people of New Jersey safer. And New Jersey's current attorney general agreed with the unanimous recommendation of the Sentencing Commission to support the restoration of judicial sentencing discretion in nonviolent drug cases. So in summary, in Section 12, the legislature only constrained judicial discretion in drug cases where the prosecutor's recommendation was less than mandated. The legislature did not mandate Section 6F terms, which take effect only on the prosecutor's application. As the prosecutor's recommendation here was greater than the sentence mandated, the legislature did not strip the court of discretion. The court should not exacerbate a severe public policy problem, namely mass incarceration, by permitting individual prosecutors to limit judicial discretion in circumstances beyond even those intended by the legislature. For all of those reasons, I would respectfully request a remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Mr. Rockoff, can you help us with a threshold question? Looking at the sentencing transcript and pointing us to passages you rely on, did the judge say, in effect, I don't have discretion under the statutes, or did the judge say, this is the sentence I'm going to be imposing, this is my judgment?
Your Honor, I would specifically point you to supplemental form filed by the judge in this case upon appeal, and I have to pull it up. But it is my understanding, based on a review of what the supplemental form, and that's that DA 16 through 18 of the appellate division brief filed by my office, that the court understood, the court believed that he had no discretion at sentencing.
Can you look at, and that form is dated May 11th. The sentencing transcript on September 8th at pages 13 and 14 shows that the judge considered aggravating and mitigating factors, weighed and made findings as to the aggravating and mitigating factors, and then concluded that the plea agreement in this case was appropriate. Did the judge, in essence, say, I'm bound and I can't do anything else as I look at the transcript? Can you show us in the sentencing transcript where the judge did what you're suggesting he did?
I had the supplemental form out. I was sorry, somebody can start with the last sentence. You know, the form should not fail over substance of the representations indicate he would be adhering to the agreed upon sentence in the plea agreement. So I take from that the judge is saying at least that he doesn't think that he has judicial sentencing discretion. I apologize.
Tell us where you're relying. I'm sorry. What page and what lines?
So that was, hang on a second. I thought it's wrong. So the court treated the sentence. So I have in my appellate division brief, the court treated the state's sentencing recommendation as binding on the judiciary. And let me look at those sites that I have. So I have,
you know,
that's the last sentence of the statement of facts that I provided in my appellate division brief.
Mr. Rakoff, let me ask you this instead.
Okay.
If in fact the judge exercised discretion in weighing the factors and concluding what the judge believed was an appropriate sentence, is the Section 12 argument that is the center of this appeal properly before the court?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's because the sentencing court believed that its hands were tied. And that no matter how the court weighed the aggravating and mitigating factors, that it had no discretion under the code to impose a lesser sentence than what the prosecutor was recommending. And that's just legally incorrect.
My question is a little different. The court believed that it could exercise and indeed did exercise discretion, is the Section 12 argument properly before the court?
Your Honors, I disagree with the underlying question. I disagree with the premise.
I'm not asking you to agree with the premise. I'm asking you, if that's what happened, assume that's what happened, and I recognize you have a different position, is the Section 12 issue then properly before the court?
If the sentencing judge believed that it had discretion at sentencing, then I would acknowledge that. The argument that I'm presenting is that the sentencing court believed that it did not have discretion at sentencing. I think that's clearly indicated by the record. Obviously, if the judge did think that it had discretion, exercised that discretion, then the question is whether or not the sentencing court believed Section 3512 applied. And it seems to me that the court clearly is indicating that his hands are tied.
Go ahead, Chief.
Why don't we move beyond? Tell us what should happen in a circumstance like this. If the defendant qualifies for an extended term and the prosecutor wants to avail him or herself of Section 12, what should happen?
If the prosecutor wants to apply for an extended term, then... So what Section 43 6F mandates is that The court shall not impose the extended term that Section 6 Act takes effect only on the prosecutor's application. And this is just straight from Ligarius, that the court shall not impose the extended term unless the ground, therefore, has been established at a hearing by a preponderance of the evidence after the court has taken notice of all relevant information. That Section 6 F applies only once the prosecutor has applied for that extended term and establishes the prior conviction. To permit effective review of prosecutorial sentencing decision, prosecutors have to state on the record in the trial court the reasons for seeking an extended sentence. Until the statutory requirements of 43-6 F are met, the prosecutor has not applied for a 43-6 F extended term.
Mr. Rockov, I take it your position is, despite the fact that the sentencing court referenced, as he was required to do, the aggravating and mitigating factors in the supplemental plea form, when the court said defendant shall be sentenced to 14 years, shall be sentenced to a 63-month parole stip, I take it your position is, based upon that language and the language during the plea colloquy, it was clear to everyone that was going to be the sentence and there was not going to be any other sentence. Is that your position?
The judge believed that there had no discretion at sentencing given what he was hearing. My position is obviously that is not correct, but based on the language in the plea form, based on what went on in the plea transcript, that the judge indicated that he had no discretion.
You're not disputing that there was a predicate crime for an extended term, are you?
No, Your Honor. It's clearly indicated.
So what this case is all about is the state's, from your perspective, failure to go through this process of applying for the extended term.
Correct. The legislature has said under 3512 that judicial discretion is not constrained unless the prosecutor's recommendation is something that's mandatory.
Counsel, wasn't that part of the specific deal that the state would not apply for an extended term in return for the reduced sentence going from 20 years to 10 years? There was no objection that I saw from the defense attorney to that. It was part of the agreement. And then now you're saying, okay, they didn't ask for it, so they could have given a minimum. Respectfully, it sounds a little bit like sandbagging to me.
No, Your Honor. I would refer you to State versus Warren. You know, the state's recommendation isn't binding.
No, I'm not talking about State versus Warren. I'm talking about what happened there. What happened here was that the state specifically agreed not to extend the term in return for the reduced sentence. And now you're saying, they didn't do it, so they have no right to proceed.
Just because the state gives up, and this is from, I know you don't want to hear about State versus Warren, but like Warren addresses the situation. Just because the state gave up something of value to the defendant, that doesn't mean that the state's recommendation is binding. So I would refer you, both parties give up substantial litigational advantages when you enter plea agreement.
I'm not saying it's binding. I'm saying that was part of the agreement, and now you're taking the task for an agreement that the defense attorney agreed to in return for the reduced sentence or the reduced plea.
So, Your Honors, the parties are in agreement with each other. Parties are not permitted to bind the court except for when specifically permitted by the legislature. So judicial discretion in sentencing, it can't be encumbered by the prosecutor's influence. Parties aren't generally empowered to negotiate a sentence that can have any binding effect. Neither the prosecutor or the defendant can bind the court. The court's rejected, this is Vasquez, the notion that a defendant could agree to divesting the court of its sentencing authority or responsibility, no matter how clear the agreement is. And that's, what happened here. The prosecutor is recommending a sentence, we know from the anti-gagging rule in Hess, defense attorneys, as happened here, because because defendants have a liberty interest, they're gonna argue if as happened here, if they're effective, that the client should get out soon. The defendant should get out sooner than what the state's recommending. The state knows the defense. State's on notice that the defendant is going to ask for less time, not only because
you haven't really answered my question, Castle. I understand what you're saying, but that's okay. You haven't really answered my question, but that's okay. I know what you're saying,
Mr. Ronkoff. Can you take us to the courtroom? I want to have a better understanding of what the public defender's position is on how these proceedings should go forward. Are you arguing that the prosecution should stand up, make a motion for the extended sentence, and then afterward withdraw and waive the extended sentence? Is that the sequence that you're suggesting needs to take place?
So I am arguing that whatever form the motion takes, whether it's formal or informal, and you know the prosecutors tried to argue, well, this wasn't a formal motion, but this also is a case where.
Can you tell us what should happen? That's my question. Just what you know, it's not a trick question here.
Okay.
How should this unfold?
So the prosecutor should has to make a decision first of all to apply for a 43-6F extended term, which didn't happen here. They agreed that they would not be applying for a 43-6F extended term. But having made the decision, yes, if it's, assuming it's done formally, that they would state that they are seeking a 43-6F extended term, state the grounds for having sought it, in terms of the statutory requirements being met, but also that it's in the interest of justice, and that this is an appropriate circumstance where despite it being a nonviolent drug offense, this is an appropriate circumstance where the court should have limited discretion. So therefore, they're applying for a 43-6F term. And then making their sentencing recommendation. And I think the problem here is that the floor was never raised.
But that's only half of it, if I understood what okay. This is all about. You're asking, number one, state should step forward, make its motion in some form, and support it. At some point, the state is going to be waiving this in this construct, right?
Yes. I mean, by waiving, you mean like the prosecutor is of course going to be making a sentencing recommendation, and whether that's in the extended term range or the ordinary term range, the issue under 3512 is it's basically is the prosecutor's recommendation greater than or less than the statutory floor, and the statutory floor is only raised the minimum mandatory term. That the court can impose is only raised according to the legislature under the statute once the prosecutor has gone through these motions. And I would point out that Section 6F is the legislature knows what it's doing. It's different from other statutes that have limited judicial discretion.
Mr. Ronkoff, I want to try this once more, and I won't belabor it. Assume you have a case in which both sides want to avail themselves of the state saying it's not going to proceed with an extended term. What needs to happen according to the public defender in that situation? Are you telling us, I think, number one, the state has to make a motion and it has to justify it, and then so that defendant has the protections that he or she would like, you have to have some form of a waiver and a promise and a plea agreement. What needs to take place in or out of court in order for that resolution to be appropriate? You start out with the state making a motion, if I heard you correctly. What happens after that? Does the judge have to rule on it? Does the state then have to waive? What are you telling us should take place going forward?
Well, I would say that at minimum, as indicated by this court in Ligeris, that prosecutors must state on the record the reasons for seeking an extended sentence. So if they want it, first step. Okay.
What next?
And then the prosecutor will make a sentencing recommendation. And you know, if once the extended term is in effect, if the like this isn't a complicated, like the state's burden here is not, the state doesn't have a significant burden here, but they still have to do it. And the reason they have to go through these steps is because the legislature did not want Section 6F terms to be mandatory in every case. So, you know, you're asking me like, well, what are all these specific steps? It is not a significant burden, but it is still different from other extended term or other mandatory statutes where they don't have to go through these steps. So for example, Section 6 Graves Act, you know, upon conviction, court automatically imposes a mandatory sentence after convicted for a qualifying offense. That's not here. So, Your Honor, I don't think that it's a burdensome procedure, but they still have to indicate on the record that there are grounds for seeking an extended term.
Forgive me. This isn't a debate about burdensomeness, about whether it's a burden. I'm trying to figure out the mechanics of the process that you're outlining, and I'm just not there from your response.
The question is, does after he's made the or she's made the motion for the extended term, does he have to go or she have to go the next step and withdraw it? If that's what's going to happen.
I would say that it's as unburdensome as as you indicated, filing an extended term and then making the recommendation, in this case for the ordinary range. It's not a burdensome procedure. By indicating that they want the floor raised, assuming the court accepts those grounds that the steps are met and that it's in the interest of justice and it's going to be imposed, that the state sentencing recommendation in the ordinary range could even serve as the state's waiver. So I don't think that it's not about burdensome mechanics.
Is it your position the judge needs to make a ruling on the motion in every case before the prosecution then withdraws?
Regardless of the judge's ruling, it has to. It's my position that the judge at some point has to indicate the prosecutors filed an extended term motion, that the grounds are met in the interest of justice. It satisfied the legislature's procedural requirements for when the extended term must be met. The floor has been raised. The prosecutor's making a sentencing recommendation in the ordinary range, and therefore under 3512, the sentencing recommendation is less than what is now mandatory. So it can be as simple as that. It's just that didn't happen here.
So let me put this question to you and to other counsel as well. Is that necessary in every case? And let me explain why I ask. In many, many instances, indeed in most instances, I imagine the parties will actually be in agreement that the defendant is extended term eligible, but that they agree on a different outcome, a different recommendation that involves a waiver. There may, however, be a small slice of cases in which there's a dispute between the parties as to whether this is a case where the defendant is eligible for an extended term, where it would be sensible for there to be a finding by the court before the state could get the benefit of Section 12. Do you need a hearing? Do you need a finding by the judge in every case? Or would it be more sensible, perhaps, for the rule to be tweaked in a way that allows the defendant to challenge those particular cases where the defendant believes this is not an extended term eligible case and Section 12 shouldn't kick in? Do you understand my question? Do you need a hearing and a finding by the judge in every single case as opposed to those that are potentially disputed cases.
I understand your question, Your Honor, and it could be in a limited subset of cases. In other words, as you just indicated, where the defense counsel is disputing that a Section 6F extended term would be mandatory or appropriate. And I think that this case falls within what would be those limited subset of cases. And I would just point you to, you know, we don't have a great view with this appellate record of, you know, what was happening in the conversations between prosecutor and defense counsel. But, you know, even in the email that Somerset County attached, appended to its brief, you know, defense counsel explicitly urges, you know, I don't believe he is a person that should be receiving an extended term. And what I take from that comment is defense counsel is saying, you know, it's not just that the state's, you know, giving something up, but rather that it's not giving up anything that it should have gotten, because counsel's taking the position that the extended term here would have been neither mandatory nor appropriate.
Mr. Rockwell, I want to follow up on a question that the Chief Justice asked of you. If at the plea hearing, the defendant stipulates that he is extended term eligible, and the court accepts that stipulation, he's extended term eligible, because the court has before it the pre-sentence investigation report that indicates predicate offenses, would that satisfy Section 6, 43-6?
No, Your Honors. Eligibility here is clearly not the same as the extended term. The prosecutor actually choosing to apply for an extended term. And that goes back to, you know, the legislature has made a choice. You know, there are some individuals who are eligible. And yet the prosecutor, in the interest of justice, will acknowledge that an extended term here would not be appropriate. And that goes to the difference, again, between Section 6F and other mandatory statutes where it's mandatory, you know, upon conviction. And I would point out that, you know...
I want to understand the procedure. Okay, I'm trying to get to the practicalities of all this. So at the plea hearing, the state would make a motion for an extended term. Here's a judgment of conviction for a predicate offense. The judge would at that point say, I find that you're extended term eligible. And then the plea would go through and the prosecutor would ask for a waiver. Is that what you're saying the process would be?
Yeah. So the prosecutor must establish that he's asking for an extended term, that it's in the interest of justice, that the predicates are met in terms of the prior convictions, and that the, you know, in terms of grounds, these are the certain circumstances where the punishment is, the extended term punishment is warranted, and where it's warranted to have the discretion of the judge be limited.
And you're saying the defendant cannot stipulate to any of those factors? They have to be presented by the prosecutor?
I mean, so I'm not saying that, you know, it can never be done informally, but it has to be done in cases where the parties agree that the prosecutor is applying for an extended term, you know, contrary to this case, then perhaps it could be done informally. But this, you know, as you indicated, so in terms of the mechanics, it may be acceptable in those, you know, I think it's the Chief Justice pointed out earlier, there may be a subset of cases where, such as I would argue this one, where the parties are in disagreement about whether an extended term should apply, where things must be more formal mechanically. But certainly if it's put on the record that the prosecutor is applying for an extended term, that the defendant acknowledges that he's eligible, that the grounds are met, then certainly in terms of judicial time management, it may not be necessary in every case. The legislature has indicated, you know, that it's not automatically mandatory. So in circumstances like this, where it's at least disputed as to whether or not the grounds are met or whether the prosecutor is applying for it, certainly, at the very least, until some of these mechanics take place, the 3512 doesn't apply because 436F has not been made mandatory.
Can you tell us briefly, one last area for me, why this is a case that would fit into that small category where there would be a dispute as to whether an extended term could apply here, should apply here?
Sure. First of all, like unique to this offender, this just isn't a case where, an extended term would be appropriate. You know, this is, again, as I indicated in my opening statement, this is his first prison sentence. It's a nonviolent drug offense where, going back to the Attorney General's comments, nonviolent drug offenses may not be an appropriate case, according to what the AG agreed to in the Criminal Sentencing Commission, for mandatory provisions stripping judicial discretion to be in effect. As far as what's more unique to my client, it was incorporated by reference what the prosecutor in Somerset County, appended to its brief, as far as like the neurology report indicating that my client has particular psychological issues. So that was appended by reference. So arguably, at least individualized to this offender, an extended term should not apply. And I would also point out, defense counsel put the state on notice of that, of his disagreement that an extended term should apply, saying, he doesn't believe that this is the person, my client, that should be receiving an extended term. Additionally, defense counsel indicated, hey, we want less than what you're asking for. So it's not just that the general anti-gagging rule that we know of in Hess, where, in accordance with the defendant's liberty interest, defense counsel is free to argue for less time. It's not just that the prosecutor generally knows defense counsel will be arguing for less time, but rather the prosecutor is specifically on notice that, the defendant wants less time, as defendants, generally do in any type of case. So in terms of the mitigating factors here, in terms of what the state was on notice of, and in terms of, the Attorney General agreeing that a nonviolent drug offense is, these may not be, these may be cases where prosecutors should be extremely cautious because of the reverberating effects over decades of limiting judicial discretion. One statistic in particular from the Criminal Sentencing Commission really jumped out at me. Thanks in large part to the CDRA, the percentage of people in New Jersey serving parole disqualifiers for which there was no judicial discretion has jumped from 11% in 1982 to 74% in 2015. And that's particular to the cases where the legislature actually intended that judicial discretion should be limited. Unlike this case, where the prosecutor, where the prosecutor's essentially asking for automatic stripping of judicial discretion, even in case where the legislature did not so clearly intend, and that's because 43(6)F, Section 6F sentences are not automatically mandatory, and therefore a prosecutor's recommendation that is greater than the floor, but less than what the prosecutor could have gotten, is not something that's below what is required, as the prosecutor intended, in order to strip judicial discretion under Section 12.
I think we have your answer to the question. Is there anything?
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Just to wrap up, I would indicate I would remind you the power in the prosecutor in this aspect, directly or indirectly, to mandate a minimum sentence is extraordinary. And that's because individual prosecutors have distinctive perceptions of the gravity of particular offenses that are different from the court. This is not a case where that mandatory extraordinary power was given. And for those reasons, it should be remanded so that the judge can appropriately exercise its discretion and as would take place in any typical ordinary sentencing hearing. So we request a remand for resentencing on that basis. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. O'Connor, and I hope that during your presentation you can at some point focus on what you would counsel as the right process going forward in this, in view of the statutes and the practical questions. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court. Aidan O'Connor, Peschenstein for the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers in New Jersey. Judge, taking your suggestion to heart, I'm going to sort of leave aside my prepared remarks and kind of go to what I think some of the questions are. It appears to me, Judge, there are three options for the state in this type of case, and what the state has done here is limited to two. It seems to me that the three options are they can make a motion and seek an extended term. They can make the motion and then waive its application, and then only that case would 2C3512 be applicable, or they can have a case and not make the motion and leave it to the discretion of the court. And what you have here, Justices, is they did not make the motion. The motion is required for the extended term to be applicable. If the state does not make the motion, the extended term is not applicable by statute. And so therefore, what we have here, given the court's jurisprudence over the years through Vasquez and Warren, is the court should not give up its discretion, should not give up its authority, unless the statute from the legislature is clear. And that is not clear the way it was done here. With regard to the procedure, Your Honor, I believe that the court would, or the state would have to make the application, the motion in every case. The court would have to make a finding in every case before someone is extended term eligible. I don't believe that that is a burden on the court. In many cases, it may be consented to by defense counsel. But that is what the statute says. The plain language of the statute says they have to make the application. They did not do so here. And so they need to make the application. And Your Honor, I'm procedurally, I think it's more a waiver than a withdrawal of the motion in terms of what happens. What I think procedurally what should happen is, in a case such as this where there's an agreement for a sentence, the state would have to make the application. The court would have to make a finding that it was appropriate by a preponderance of the evidence as set forth in the statute. And then the state, pursuant to the plea agreement, would waive the application extended term and then agree to some lesser sentence within the ordinary term. In that
Mr.
case,
O'Connor.
Only in that case would the court's discretion be bound.
Mr. O'Connor, we know defendants, of course, can waive constitutional protections as long as they do so knowingly and voluntarily. Why can't they waive a procedural protection in a statute with the advice of counsel?
Obviously, you can waive your right to trial. You can waive all sorts of stuff, Your Honor, but I think here this statute sets forward what needs to be done, and in this case it wasn't done. And here it's the opposite. It's not what we have here is not that they that he waived it. They made an agreement that the state wouldn't seek the extended term. That's not the same as waiving it. I think the better practice, Your Honor, would be to have a consent to that motion and a consent pursuant to the plea agreement that the state would then waive its application.
What would be wrong with a stipulation? In the majority of these sorts of cases, I imagine both sides are going to agree. This is an extended term eligible case, and defendants do not want the state to make that application and are willing to resolve the matter. What would be wrong with a stipulation in those kinds of cases where there's no dispute about the eligibility for an extended term?
I think, Your Honor, it winds up becoming the same as the consent to the motion. I think the cleaner practice would be then just to consent to the motion and then have the agreement to waive. But without that finding by the judge, much as in a plea, the judge has to make a finding that there's a factual basis. He has to make certain findings on the record. And I think what's missing here, before the court gives up its authority and cedes it to the state, there has to be that judicial finding. And that's what we don't have here.
So your position, I take it, is even if there is a stipulation, the court has to find that there's a basis supporting the stipulation?
Yes, Your Honor. And if I could just, Your Honor,
let me ask one question and then you'll proceed, please. Explain what you think would be inadequate about a process along these lines. The state makes plain that they believe this case is extended term eligible and that they're prepared to waive doing that. And the defendant would have the opportunity to say, I disagree, calling for a judicial finding. Would there be a problem with building that process into a rule?
I'm trying to think about what you said, Judge. The issue is, yes, in many cases there will be an agreement. And there will be, you know, much as you can consent to other motions, I think that the process should be whether the defendant can consent to the application pursuant to the plea agreement. And I'm not sure if we're just arguing about the procedure here, but I think what we have here is we don't have that procedure, we don't have that consent, we don't have the actual application. And when we have this, the state saying, well, it's just a formality, we could have done it, we would have done it, we might have done it, I don't think that's enough. That's like saying, well, we could have indicted you, but we didn't, but you know, we had enough stuff and we could have indicted you, so what's the difference? Now, obviously, you can waive indictment, so I understand that, but there has to be something set up where they actually have to make the motion before they take away the court's discretion. And that's the issue.
I take it you're also saying that even if there is a stipulation or consent, the court has to make a finding on the record that the defendant, therefore, is extended term eligible. I find him eligible for an extended term. There has to be that finding.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And your position is the defendant could not say, Judge, that's not necessary in this case, because I do not dispute that I'm extended term eligible and that it could be appropriate in this case. That's the part that I'm asking you to focus on.
Judge, I think you're skipping the step, and I don't think that's what we want to do. I think that if there's a consent that the defendant stands up, so I don't want to oppose the motion because you know, the government's with the certified judgment of conviction, I think that's the process that we should have, is that if that's going to go forward, the defendant can up there and say, Judge, we don't oppose the motion because in this plea agreement, we have the state has agreed to waive that extended term. That's the procedure I think the court should use.
Go ahead, Chief. As an experienced defense counsel, are these cases disputed for the most part where there is a resolution of the sort that we see here?
I think at this point a lot of them are not, because there's such a heavy hammer because of the extended term that people don't believe that they can fight them, because you're going from a 10 to 20 to a 20 to life. So in many cases, that huge hammer over you forces you your hand in terms of the plea.
Mr. O'Connor,
in this
particular case, if the court were to agree and send it back, could the state now say, fine, we are not willing to waive the extended term, we're going to make a new application, and we're seeking a 20 to life? It's a clean slate. Why not? The deal is completely off the table based on what happened, and there's no sentencing agreement of any kind, and the state now seeks extended term and is not willing to waive it. What happens then?
Well, that may be more a question for Mr. Rockoff, but I believe that they could not do that, Judge, because they'd be punishing him for exercising his right to appeal.
Mr. O'Connor, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Justice Alvin.
I take it your position is that a defendant could not stipulate to a factual basis when, in fact, there is no factual basis. Even in that circumstance, a court has to make a determination. And I take it your position is the same with respect to the extended term. Even if there's a stipulation, the court has to, on its own, make a determination that the defendant is, in fact, extended term eligible.
That's correct, Your Honor. We're talking about a serious lengthening of a sentence exposure, and we're talking about a giving away of the court's authority and discretion against sentencing, which is one of the most important things that courts do. And this court in Roth and in Warren have noted how sentencing is one of the most important things they do. And many judges have said how it's the hardest thing to do. And I don't think it should just be given away to the prosecutor without the requisite findings being made.
Other questions, anyone?
Can I just respond to something?
Of course.
Yes, Your Honor, if I might. Justice Fernandez, when you had sort of made a reference that he thought that there might be some sandbagging going on here. And, Judge, I don't think that's the issue. That sort of seems to be what was going on sub rosa in the Brinson, the unpublished case relied on by the state. And, you know, there's sort of this feeling that somehow in that case, the defendant and his counsel claimed they were confused by the nature of the plea and that somehow the defendant was trying to get over on the court.
Counsel, I don't think there's any confusion here at all. That's the problem to me, is that the entire agreement was based on that state not seeking the extended term, and then at the plea agreement was entered into based on those terms, then counsel said, well, we want less because the argument was they didn't seek the extended term by motion. So I don't think there was any confusion at all here, unlike the case you cite.
I agree, Judge. But I think this case is more like the Vasquez case, where there had been an agreement there that if the defendant violated probation and then came back, the state would not agree to waive the extended term at that point. And there was no question there as to that was the terms of the agreement. And there, much as here, I would argue, we're talking, the real issue is the court's authority, not what someone understood in the agreement. The issue here is that the court should not and cannot give up its authority, its discretion at sentencing, without a clear legislative pronouncement. And you don't have that here. And you don't have that unless the state makes the application, unless the court makes the finding. And that's why I think this is different, Your Honor. And the issue as to whether this is what he agreed to and therefore he should have to live with it, that's not the issue this court should be concerned about. The issue the court should be concerned about is the court's authority and discretion at sentencing.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Heintzel.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. This case involves an express waiver by the state of its undisputed right to seek a mandatory extended term under 43.6F, for which defendant concededly qualified. And I want to emphasize that just for the moment, given some of the back and forth so far this morning. In the pretrial memorandum that was signed by the defendant, he agreed that he was subject to 43.6F. There was no dispute. Then thereafter, there was further plea negotiations, as indicated by the email that I attached to my supplemental brief. And so an agreement was reached. The base term was dropped down on the defendant's request from 24 years to 14 years. He got exactly what he wanted. The parole stip was 63 months, which was in accordance with the Brimage guidelines. This is a table four case for a first degree offense, which called for a stip of 63 months. Now, in exchange for waiving that, he got a lesser sentence than he would have been exposed to had this been an extended term case. And the agreement was clearly that lesser sentence would in fact be imposed and he would not get a lesser sentence. That is, by definition, a Section 12 case. Now, it's important here to look for a moment at the plea form and the guilty plea colloquy. Both make crystal clear that everyone concerned, the defendant, the prosecutor, and the trial judge, all understood that this express waiver by the state made this a case governed by 235.12. And that's why the supplemental plea form for non-negotiated pleas, which was sort of like imported into service here, although that's a form used for other instances, but it was signed by both parties and the judge. And it says, defendant shall, underline shall, be sentenced to 14 years in New Jersey State Prison. Defendant shall, underline shall, be sentenced to a 63-month parole stip. This plea agreement is in exchange for the state not to file an extended term pursuant to NJSA.
Okay, Mr. Heintzel, let me ask you this question. And if the defendant had been charged with murder and pled guilty to aggravated manslaughter, and let's say he had the same language, defendant shall be sentenced to 14 years, all of the same language, you wouldn't be arguing, would you, that the court didn't have discretion?
No.
Would you?
No. That would be a case.
That would be State versus Warren.
Correct.
State versus Hess, correct?
That's right.
Okay, so my question to you here is, without the judge making express findings that the defendant, in fact, was extended term eligible, how can there be a waiver of that extended term when the statute specifically requires a hearing and some sort of finding by the trial court?
That's only if we're actually seeking the extended term. Here, we're not proceeding under 43.6F because we're not actually seeking it. There, yes, we do have to file the motion for the extended term. There, yes, we do have to prove the existence of the prior qualifying conviction by a preponderance of the evidence. Those are the procedural requirements under that statute. Under 2C3512, we don't have any of those requirements imported over. I mean, I've read that provision 100 times in anticipation of this argument. And I don't see anywhere where all the procedural prerequisites to 43.6F are carried over here. Now,
you're suggesting that there can be a waiver of an extended term without a finding that the defendant, in fact, was extended term eligible by the court?
I think if there's a dispute, as the chief put forth before, if there's some dispute, absolutely, that can be litigated. But it can also be stipulated, where it essentially was here, given the pretrial memorandum in which he agreed he was eligible under 43.6F. There may be cases where it's disputed, and in those cases, absolutely, there should be a hearing to see if the prior conviction qualifies him. And then, if it's ruled that he does, then the defendant obviously can go back with counsel and consider whether he's willing to accept this 3512 plea. That's the way I feel about that. As far as, like, other indicia that this was a 3512 plea, I wanted to just draw the court's attention to something specific, and I hadn't done it in my brief, but I'd like to do it here. And that is the supplemental plea form for drug offenses, which is attached at DA-7, the defendant's appellate division brief, and which is also part of the plea form here. Question one of that form asks, and I quote, "Have you and the prosecutor entered into any agreement to provide for a lesser sentence for a period of parole ineligibility than would otherwise be required?" Defendant circled yes to that, and then the form says, if yes, be sure to include in questions 12 and 13 above. Question 12 was left blank because that talks about dismissed counts, but question 13 reads, quote, "State and defendant agreed that defendant will be sentenced to 14 years in New Jersey State Prison with 63 months to be served without parole. This plea agreement is based on the state's agreement not to file an extended term pursuant to NJSA 2C43.6F. That was done expressly to waive and to flag that this is a 2C3512 case. I think that, plus the supplemental plea form for non-negotiated cases, plus the colloquy at the guilty plea itself, all make extremely plain that this was a waiver.
So what if the state is waiving something that it really doesn't really have? Because typically you'd have to prove by preponderance of the evidence. It's very easy to do that. Well, I'm not going to be seeking an extended term because maybe there isn't the basis for actually getting one from the court, or the court may not find it. Why should that be controlling?
Well, the defendant can always dispute it. We don't, in fact, the court could ask defense at the time, you know, do you stipulate that you qualify for an extended term? Do you stipulate that you have the prior qualifying conviction? Nobody's asking us to take it on our word alone, that this matter can be resolved that way on the record in a less formal way than us then having to trot out the prior conviction, which nobody's disputing. If the judge is satisfied that the defendant has stipulated to it, that should be enough. And
that there's a basis. for, I gave the example to Mr. O'Connor, and you can respond to it. A defendant can't stipulate that he's committed an offense. The court has to take a plea colloquy and determine for itself that, in fact, all of the elements are satisfied by the factual basis. Why doesn't that same approach apply here? Even when there is a stipulation, the court still has to make certain findings that the stipulation is supported by the evidence.
Well, it would be a totality of the evidence, and I think under 43.6F, it talks about various things that a court can take judicial notice of in determining whether it's satisfied that the prerequisites have been met. It can be the pre-sentence report. It can be a judgment of conviction. If the state wants to submit to the court in advance a copy of the judgment of conviction it's relying on, I don't see why that would be insufficient. I still say that a defendant with the assistance of competent counsel can stipulate, because generally these things are not disputed. Generally, whether somebody qualifies under 6F for an extended term is not really a matter of dispute. It's not because it's a heavy hammer or anything like that. It's because the basis for seeking an extended term is so straightforward, and it's proven by public record. Now, 2C3512 doesn't speak to and doesn't import, as I said before, all the procedural prerequisites to actually getting the extended term. I can't emphasize enough, we're not actually seeking an extended term here. We're waiving it. We're waiving the extended term in accord with the defense's wishes in this case. He got exactly what he wanted. Now, 2C3512 says nothing about moving for an extended term as a prerequisite to invoking the construct of 3512. And to get back to the Chief's question to the other side as how we would go about actuating, how we would go about invoking 2C3512, and I think the answer to that is it can be done in one of two ways. It can be done, one, the way that Mr. Rockhoff has set forth, and that is by actually moving for the extended term and then essentially waiving it, agreeing to a lesser sentence. Here, that was the lesser sentence was, of course, imposed here. And number two, we could do as was done here, and before I get into two, I wanted to just emphasize that these two ways both preserve the important element of judicial review. So any judge looking at that will say, yes, that's obviously a 3512 plea. And here, that was done by the clear terms of the plea agreement, here in a form signed by the plea judge, noting that or implying that this falls under 3512 by expressly linking the waiver of the mandatory extended term to the fact that the sentence would in fact be imposed and would not be reduced.
Mr. Heintzel, did the court ever make an express finding that the defendant was extended term eligible based upon its review of submissions by the state?
I don't think that ever came up, Your Honor. I think that was understood. I don't think he was asked to make that finding. I'd have to look at the plea transcript again, but I don't believe he was ever asked to do that. I think it was understood by all concerned that the defendant was extended term eligible. So here you have, but to get back to how I said, as if the plea agreement clearly sets forth the linkage between the extended term eligibility and the fact that we're not seeking that, we're instead seeking these precise terms, because that's what 2C3512 speaks in terms of when there's a lesser sentence and you've got a specific base term and a specific parole disqualifier, then the sentencing judge cannot go below that. And of course, this
Mr. Heintzel, I want you to go back to where you started. You said there were two options. Number one, state makes a motion and then waives afterward. Tell us what number two is.
Okay, number two is what I was trying to explain, is when you present under the clear terms of a plea agreement, that noting that the sentence falls under 3512 by expressly linking the waiver of the mandatory extended term to the fact that the sentence can't be reduced. And here, when you look at the totality of the documents that were submitted and the totality of what was put forth on the record, it's overwhelmingly clear. I think the defense doesn't even dispute the clarity of everything that was done on the record here. Not only the question in the supplemental plea form for non-negotiated pleas, but also, as I mentioned before, the supplemental plea form for drug offenses, which specifically says we are pleading to a lesser sentence than would otherwise be required. I think under all those circumstances, it's absolutely plain that this is a 2C3512 plea.
Do you need to build in an additional step to your second option? You placed in the form of the plea agreement, you've given the defendant notice this is what the state intends. Doesn't the defendant then have to have an opportunity to raise a challenge if he or she believes there is a dispute?
Yes, they can raise the challenge if they believe there's a dispute. They're absolutely entitled to do that. I also think that we're not trying to avoid any sort of like guidelines or judicial oversight in terms of, you know, having to put forth the basis on the record and then for judicial review, which was done here. I mean, and then also to allow the defendant to challenge this as arbitrary and capricious. Because this isn't like under the Ligarez guidelines, because again, we're not actually seeking the extended term. This comes more under the Brimage and Vasquez guidelines because we're waiving it under Section 12.
So, Mr. Heinzel, what would be so difficult if at the time of the plea, when the court is making a finding that there's a factual basis for the plea, the court will also say there's a factual basis for an extended term, and now I'm approving the plea bargain wavering? Like, what would be so difficult about that procedure?
I think that procedure would be pretty easy. I think going forward, to use language that we talked about, I think one of the last times I was before this court, going forward, that may be an appropriate thing. But right here, we're looking at the record as it was formulated without that more clear guidance that you're speaking of. Now, and just to get back to the Chief's questions at the very beginning of the argument as to what the sentencing court believed, whether he believed he was mandated, I think you look at the sentencing transcript itself, it doesn't indicate that. It doesn't indicate that at all. He notes the plea agreement, but he then goes through the weighing of the aggravating and mitigating factors, finds 3, 6, and 9, finds no mitigating factors, and says the plea agreement is appropriate, which is done whenever a judge accepts a sentence contemplated by a plea. It was only when this case came up on appeal, well, a long time later, and long time after the judgment of conviction itself was even entered, that Judge Pacheco then amplified his reasoning and backfilled it with additional information as contained in the plea forms. So with that said, I think the record here is more than adequate to sustain this sentence. I think the manner pursued here for nailing down that this was a 2C3512 plea was sufficient. And if going forward, the court wishes to impose additional requirements along the lines that have been mentioned here today, none of them sounded very onerous at all, and I don't think the state would object to that on a prospective basis.
Thank you, Mr. Heinz. Ms. Kamisiak.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Given the discussion that's already taken place this morning, I would like to focus my remarks on three main areas. The first is to respond to the Chief Justice's question about whether a hearing or a formal process should be required in every case. And the Attorney General believes that a hearing would not be required in every single case. Instead, the more sensible approach would be to have a hearing only where there is a dispute about the defendant's extended term eligibility. And we anticipate that is probably more the rare case. And here, that would not be such a rare case. The defendant has never disputed that he had the prior conviction from 2010 for possession of cocaine with intent to distribute. That has been conceded throughout. So there really would be no basis for a hearing. And Justice Alvin had asked whether the court ever made a specific finding that the defendant had an defendant was extended term eligible. The closest I could find was in the sentencing transcript on page 13. The court asks the prosecutor, this was also the second indictable conviction. The prosecutor says, it is, Your Honor, he has a prior for possession with intent as well. And then the court says, the court notes this is a second indictable conviction. The previous conviction was also for manufacturing distribution of CDS heroin. It was actually cocaine, but in any event, the court did make that finding. The court did have the pre-sentence report in front of it, and the defendant has never disputed his statutory eligibility for that mandatory extended term. I know Mr. Rockoff had stated that, he's not saying that that's not conceded, but that there was other issues, perhaps, that would make the defendant not appropriate for an extended term. And the Attorney General would submit that presumably those are the issues that were brought to the Somerset County Prosecutor's Office attention in being able to reduce the sentence from the original original offer of 24 years down to the 14 years, which again is not an extended term sentence. The second issue I would like to discuss is the process or the procedure that was actually employed here. And the Attorney General's position is that what was done here was appropriate and was the functional equivalent of what we're talking about and that the defense counsel has proposed, which is to move for an extended term and then recommend a lesser sentence. Here, that's really the functional equivalent. And I would agree and echo the remarks by Mr. Heinzel that we have to look at 3512 and 43.6F together. Because the state did not actually move for the extended term, 43.6F really doesn't apply. It's more 3512, which the appellate division in this case recognized does not require by its plain terms a formal motion to be made for an extended term. I also wanted to raise, just briefly, we had put it in our brief, but it wasn't discussed yet today, is the court rule, which is Court Rule 3:21-4E. And that court rule explicitly applies to extended term sentences under 43.6F. And under that court rule, there's no formal motion actually required. What is required instead is the prosecutor's oral notice that they would be seeking an extended term, and then the extended term exposure being recorded in the plea agreement and plea papers itself. And here, that was effectively complied with. The state provided oral notice at the time of the plea that the defendant was extended term eligible. The defendant has never disputed that. It's abundantly clear throughout the record and the plea forms that that this is what the state was doing. The state was giving up its right to seek this mandatory extended term in exchange for this negotiated sentence that would be binding on the court. And as one appellate panel had said, I believe it was the Brinson panel, giving up an otherwise mandatory extended term or mandatory sentence is an essential ingredient of a plea under Section 12. So that
can I ask you a question about the overlay of the State versus Thomas? You're familiar with State versus Thomas?
There's two State versus Thomases.
About the Supreme, the one that was written by Justice LaVecchia.
Okay.
So, I want to. This is my understanding because there were Apprendi issues mm-hmm. with respect to extended terms. So, in a case like this, assume no plea agreement, and mm-hmm. the defendant was convicted of this first degree, and you mm-hmm. sought extended term and received extended term.
Yes.
Tell me if I'm mistaken. The judge would be considering from 10 up. He wouldn't start with 20. And the reason, am I mistaken about that? But
yes, Your Honor, only because the statute explicitly provides that it's 20 to life. The statute
because it's
takes
not-
the...
Okay, because it's not discretionary. Thomas was a discretionary.
Yes.
I see Mr. Heinzel. Okay. Okay.
Yes.
So this falls out of the Thomas category for that reason.
Absolutely. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Sure. I don't think that there's any reason a defendant can't stipulate to, as was done here, that they're extended term eligible. And again, that's going to be backed up by, that's not just going to be a stipulation, but that would be backed up by a pre-sentence report. And, you know, in these cases, the state also should be prepared, if there is any dispute, to come forward with the prior judgment of conviction. But I think it's a little different than what Justice Albin's example of a defendant can't stipulate to the fact that he committed an offense. There has to be a factual basis. I think that the fact of a prior conviction is an objective fact, and that's going to be backed up either by the documents or not. And so the defendant is going to be in the best position to know his prior record. And we think, again, it'll be the rare case. And this is not that rare case. One other point I just wanted to briefly touch on. Mr. Rockhoff had mentioned a few times certain aspects of the Sentencing Commission and the Attorney General's remarks. And just respectfully, I would submit that issue is not before the court. The Sentencing Commission, whatever will happen with the Sentencing Commission in the future, if any recommendations are actually adopted or not adopted, that's something for, you know, another day. But what we have here is a question of the interpretation of the law as it exists now. And so for all of the reasons that were set forth by Mr. Heinzel and myself this morning and more fully in our briefs, we believe that the process employed here was appropriate. This was clearly a Section 12 plea agreement, and to afford defendant the opportunity to go back and to have the judge consider a lesser sentence here would be a complete windfall benefit when it is clear, abundantly clear, crystal clear from this record that this was a Section 12 plea agreement. Unless the court has any other questions, the Attorney General would ask this court to affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Kamisiak. Mr. Rockhoff, rebuttal. You need to unmute yourself, please. Please unmute yourself.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sorry about that. Just briefly, first I would just go back to the point is I think Mr. O'Connor sort of crystallized just the real issue here is the court's authority and discretion sentencing, that the court does not give up its authority but for a clear legislative pronouncement. The parties can't agree to constrain the court's authority except as directed by statute. This is a penal statute. It's constrained. It's interpreted strictly. And this is not just going by the plain language of the statute. This isn't how discretion would be limited. I want to, though, go to a more specific point, which is so even if this court were to find that the court had no discretion as the base term, there should still be a remand for resentencing for discretion as to the pro disqualifier specifically. So both 35.5 and 43.6F say that the court has discretion to impose a pro disqualifier between one-third and one-half of the sentence imposed. So even if the court's recommended base term of 14 years is binding, the court had discretion to impose a pro disqualifier down to one-third of that, which is 56 months, 7 months less than the 63 months recommended by the state. So I would further refer this court to the Brimage Guidelines, which says on page 12, whenever the Brimage Guidelines require a prosecutor to tender a plea offer greater than the minimum term of parole and eligibility required to be imposed by law, which here is one-third, then the Brimage offer becomes, in essence, a non-binding sentencing recommendation to the court, which the court would be free to accept or reject. And the reduction of the recommendation to statutory minimum, the pro disqualifier is warranted here. So I would point out to court, the Brimage charge recommendation treat 43.6F eligibility as equivalent to application, even when, like here, no application was made. So there may be some room to go down for the category of offenders where the state has declined to apply for an extended term. And I would close by, since we're talking about pro disqualifiers, you know, I would go back to the AG's comments. I know this is going back to what the Ms. Kamisiak just indicated. Well, the AG did say, agreed in the with the unanimous recommendation, acknowledged that judges should have discretion in sentencing, at least for parole disqualifiers, at least for nonviolent drug use, nonviolent drug offenses. And respectfully, the AG also agreed with the principle that that should be retroactive. So, you know, this goes to why it's so important that the court's discretion not be so limited, except in cases where the prosecutor has actually applied for, gone through all the procedural requirements laid out by the statute and by the legislature. I would contend that even the AG himself is in agreement with that point, that the parole disqualifier specifically, that it should be a rare case where the judge has discretion stripped away from him. So for all those reasons, I will rely on my remarks, and I request a resentencing remand for my client. Thank you very much.
You have to unmute yourself, Chief.
Thank you, Justice. We will take the matter under advisement.